All right, thank you. So we're coming to the second part of the book in section one, and I've entitled it Nothing Makes Sense. I think that's what he's going to be saying in this section, just about. Whatever happens, he says, has already been assigned by God, you see. Keep in mind the limits of this book. So he's got certain assumptions that we don't accept, don't grant. There are a lot of big things he didn't see. And one of them is just, well, God's organised everything that's happening, so what do you do about it? The course of human beings is known. They're not able to dispute with the one who's stronger than they are. Brackets, God. The more words we use, the less sense we make. So what's the point? What's the point is my translation of Hebel. Who knows what is good for human beings in life in the few days of their fleeting existence? They'll pass through them like a shadow. Who can tell them what their future will be under the sun? Who knows what is good for human beings in life in the few days of their fleeting existence? They'll pass through them like a shadow. Just a couple of psalms that say much the same thing. Human beings, says the psalmist, is like a breath. Their days are like a passing shadow. Again, another psalm. He remembered that they were but flesh, a breath that passes and doesn't come again. Another psalm. When their breath departs, their spirit, they return to the earth, and on that very day their plans perish. So let me read to you while you just... It's better, he says... He's quoting some... excuse me. There's a number of proverbial sayings that claim to know that one thing is better than another. And that's the difficulty of reading this passage. Sometimes he's saying things that are said, and he'll show you that he doesn't agree with them. Sometimes he's saying things that he wants you to hear. Sometimes he has... King Solomon saying things from his position and he's going to question them. So it's a bit subtle and I'm not sure I've got it right, but he gives a list of proverbial sayings here, and they're given as examples of the many words that he's just spoken about that claim to find meaning and direction in life. But how reliable are these words, these maxims, these wise sayings that have come down through the tradition and people learn them at school and they're in the catechism, as it were, and they're questioning them. Even if they contain an element of truth, when you take them all together, these are my words, of course, but I'll give you the words in a minute, when you take them all together, there's so much empty talk. And this is what he says then. It's better to go to the house of mourning than to a house of feasting. Thank you. Since this is the end of everyone, let the living take it to heart. So it's better to go to a wake than a wedding. Sorrow is better than laughter, for in the sadness of the countenance, the heart will be glad. You've got to ask yourself, what do you make of all this? The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. The heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It's better to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of fools. Like a lovely image, like a crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of fools. But this also is vanity. surely oppression makes the wise foolish. So, house of mourning, is it better? A bribe corrupts the heart. Better is the end of a matter than its beginning. The patient in spirit are better than the proud of spirit. Be not quick to anger, for anger lodges in the bosom of fools. Don't say, why were the former days better than these? Every grandparent says that. Every parent says it. And there are people who think the church was better off before the Vatican Council. That's not in this book. It's my little comment. The old days were good. You know, when Catholics could walk down the main road singing how glorious St. Patrick and cursing the Protestants were much better days. Why do we... The former days were better than these. And the young people of our generation, were the young people of today, you know, they're not at church. They're living together before they're married. And they're... You know, what's going... You know, what's... It's not from wisdom that you ask this. Wisdom, he says, is as good as an inheritance, an advantage to those who see the sun. For wisdom is as a shadow. Money is as a shadow. Knowledge is an advantage. Wisdom lets its possessor live. Don't say, well, that's the only verse I've put there. Don't say, why were the former days better than these? It's not from wisdom that you ask this. Brackets. Surely our job as a church, as a people, as parents, as grandparents, as priests, as brothers, as whatever you are, as catechists, surely our job is to see what's beautiful in the young and delight in it, because if we do, they will make better decisions. Being loved, you always make a better decision when you're loved. And it doesn't mean we say everything they're doing is right. We give them the wisdom, we cry when they're hurting. We say to them, look, there's a lot more to this than... I had a marriage preparation last night, and it was just lovely talking to the couple about the sacrament of marriage. You know, what it is, because it's, once again, I don't know what to say, I won't finish that sentence, but for them to know that marriage is the sacrament of love, meaning, if it's a sacrament, means it's a visible sign showing everybody God's love. Like, particularly love. All the sacraments have got their aspect. But to see that, that means that every time the husband loves his wife, whatever way, and there are hundreds of ways of loving, as you know, every time he loves her, that's a sacrament of God's love for her. So she's receiving his love, but there's also a depth to it and a mystery to it, isn't there? Well, you know all this, but I mean, don't young people need to know this? That that's what they're doing when they make love? That they're actually calling on the divine in them and the divine in the other person, and they're giving themselves, and you know, so it's a kind of totally wonderful thing. And every time they're loving each other, they are a sacrament. So somehow we have to not compare, because the generations are changing every 5 years, aren't they, or something? I don't know what we're up to now, Generation X or Y or Z, or I can't keep up with it. But we've got to love them into life, and yet, well, who's it? Khalil Gibran talks about parents being like a bow, you know, and the child is an arrow. And like they go into the future beyond anything we could ever dream of, but we have to stand steady and be who we are and hand our values on to them, at the same time wondering at the new things that they'll discover. Now back to Ecclesiastes. Whatever happens, consider the activity of God. Who can make straight what God has made crooked? when good times come, here it is again, accept the good. Back to your point, Francis, really look at the beautiful things glimmering in the sun as you hang them out on the line. I think that's marvellous. It might take the moment, whatever joy is in it. In bad times, consider that God has made the one as well as the other, so that we can't know what is coming next. In my fleeting lifetime, says Kohelet, I've seen both. There are righteous people who perish while being righteous, and there are wicked people who live long while being wicked. And that goes against all the maxims of the wisdom that are handed on. That God, if you're wise, God will give you a long life and, you know, all that success. Success theology is rampant in the United States. And it's rampant here when we I don't want to blame the United States, but that's where it seems to come from. In our, a lot of fundamentalist churches are very success-oriented. It'll be successful and graceful and all that beautiful stuff. It's one good thing, I reckon, about the Catholic Church is that we do take pain seriously. And I think we're pretty realistic about death and suffering and when people really have to really live, that's where they need to come. They need to come back to the, I don't mean just the Roman Catholic Church, but the traditional churches that are Christian right to their roots, that's where we have to go. So, in my fleeting lifetime, I've seen this. Traditional wisdom asserts, I've just said that, the good are rewarded with long life and the wicked perish. Here, as throughout his work, the author of Ecclesiastes asks us to look at the facts and look at them square on and honestly, and our wisdom collapses. Don't be too righteous, he says. Don't act too wise, lest you be in for a shock. That's pretty good, isn't it? Don't be too wicked. Don't be a fool, lest you die before your time. Riding a Harley in your 60s, I mean, honestly. It's better that you should take hold of the one. This is pretty good, isn't it? It's better to take hold of the one without letting go of the other. So, for the one who fears God will venture forth in life with both. We're a bit wise and we're a bit bloody stupid. One of my brothers, Jim, who gave me advice when I went into the novitiate, was dash good advice too. He said, look, every now and then, because I must have been a pretty serious, innocent little 16-year-old I was, I went to the novitiate, 16 and a half or something, because I'd finished school. And he said, every now and then, sit on the bottom of your bed and have a good laugh at yourself. You know, like, don't take yourself too seriously. And then when I was professed, my eldest brother, Brian, met me on the thing and he said, because he was in the Air Force, is he, going up in these Lancaster bombers and the one in front gets shot down. They had the biggest loss of comparative life, the bomber command. So you didn't know what was going to happen. You're going in of war, out into a war and then out of a war. And into, he said, his good advice too, he said, whatever you do, always live in the present moment. That's not bad. From somebody who's had to do it. So you, some things you don't forget, do you? Because the person who says them knows. So it actually connects. So Kohelet's advice is for us not to be overconfident in our righteousness or our wisdom. Don't assume that if we were more righteous or more wise, things would be better for us. It doesn't work that way, he says. This doesn't mean that wisdom is of no value, of course. Being excessively foolish doesn't lead anywhere, he says that. Her advice is to accept ourselves as we are, a little wise, but a little foolish too. That's the way we're made. And when you're a bit foolish, sit on the end of your bed and have a good laugh at yourself. Today we might say, my little comment, we might embrace our shadow side, you know, the whole of you, embrace that part of you that is not functioning too well. Let me read to you for a little bit. Wisdom is more significant to the wise, says Coelet, than wealth to the property owners in the city. But there's no one on earth so righteous as to do only good without ever sinning. I think I said it last week. I said it at the baptism, another thing that happened at the baptism. But original sin, it's the sin of our origins. It's a recognition by the wisdom of our world, right back, that when I sin, meaning when I stumble or miss the mark, which is what the Hebrew means and the Greek means, they both mean that. So I miss the mark, in other words, I'm lost, I'm bushed, and I'm trying to do something but it doesn't work out. Or I'm trying to be kind to someone, I end up hurting them, but I didn't mean to, but they did get hurt. All of that stuff that life has in it. It's a recognition that when I stumble or sin, miss the mark, it's not all my fault. It's not all personal sin for which I should be guilty and take responsibility. There are things that we should do that for, and guilt's good. And responsibility is good. But a lot of the sin in our life comes, we don't know where it comes from. It might be the way we were treated as little children. You can't even remember it. And when you went to school, and aren't all primary school children so thoughtful and lovely to their other primary school children? If you're fat, they'll never call you fat. And if you're thin, they'll never call you thin. And if you're no good at sport, they'll never say, you're hopeless. They're all so positive, aren't they? Do you find that, little children? So you've got to cop it sweet, and your sisters and brothers, they're a bit realistic too. So it's the sin we inherit that's come down to us in our genes. And mum and dad might be doing the best, but your poor mother might have had a very difficult childhood, maybe got too many kids or something, and she's psychologically very difficult. And you're the little child, you don't know any of that, and she's doing her best, she's loving you with all the love she's got, but she hasn't got a lot left, do you know what I mean? So you get hurt, or then someone else comes in and you weren't prepared, and you've got this little baby getting all the attention, and all the rest of you know better than I. So you got all that stuff, and then you've got the environment. We're born into an environment that can be very sinful and broken, and it is, and every environment is, and some are worse than others. So original sin is saying that's what we're inheriting, and then in that world, what's happening at baptism is Jesus is embracing you and he'll never let you go. So you've got that grace through the church community, and hopefully your parents will bring you along to the Eucharist, and you'll do it. It's delightful being a priest, or some of you are also ministers of the Eucharist. But it's a great, isn't it beautiful when you have these little tiny children coming up and to get a blessing, but they want more than a blessing. They want their share of the feast. They're so beautiful. And I kneel down next to them, because they get down there, of course, and say to them, look, darling, you have to be just a little bit older, and then we'll give you communion. They look at you just to say, who are you and why can't I, But anyhow, it's hopefully their parents will introduce them into the community, and hopefully the community will welcome them. And hopefully the parents are also a bit sensible. So if the child's making mayhem, you should take the child out, don't you think? Because all the people around you... I never say that. I said it once, because I just wasn't coping at all with this child who's with a grandparent, and the child was just yelling all the time. So I wasn't coping too well. So I said, I'll have to ask you to do something with that child, I said, because I can't cope. And so the grandmother did take the child out, but she should have done it a bit earlier, do you know what I mean? Just for the sake of the people around her, if nothing else. But in any case, I'm sorry I'm going on. No one on earth is so righteous as to do only good without ever sinning. Like, we all stumble. Sometimes it's our fault, sometimes it's not. And it's not good to presume it's your fault all the time either and get all too guilty about it. Learn from it well, I've got to learn from mistakes I've made, and hopefully I am learning. Learn from it, and maybe it keeps you humble, I don't know what. All that's really important. But not whacking yourself, because the more hard you are on yourself, the more hard you are on everybody around you. So don't take to heart the things that people say, he says. You may hear your servant slighting you, slave really, but very often your heart knows that you have yourself slighted others. All this I've tested by wisdom, and I said I will be wise, but it was far from me. All that happens is inaccessible and unfathomable. Who can work it out? I set my heart to know and to search out and to seek wisdom and to account for the way things are and to know what wickedness, that wickedness is folly and foolishness is madness. And by the way, the word for foolishness in that sentence, if you've got a good memory, is siklut. I mentioned it to you a couple of weeks ago, because the word in Hebrew for prudence is also siklut with a different S on the front. Here's the one with the samek, foolishness. Here is what I have found out. So as a result of all that thinking, and more bitter than death. Girls, just be, listen now. There might be some truth in this for you. More bitter than death is a woman who is a snare. When her heart is a trap and her arms chains. Our author, by the way, absolutely typical for his generation, and it didn't stop with his generation. They always assume that if something's wrong, cherchez la femme. It's the woman is to blame for a bloke getting carried away. Hopefully we don't think that, but it's a bit of that in him. When God so pleases, a man can escape from the chains of a woman's embrace or the trap of her heart, but the one who fails, you'll get caught. Hands up those who got... No. But put it into... you can't paint it over. There is not a misogyny, and that's not it. Because look what he said earlier. Go back, Ecclesiastes 4:9-12. Two are better than one, he's saying. And I think, John, this includes marriage, I think. Two are better than one because they have a good outcome for their toil. For if either of them should fall, he said this last week, the other will lift them up. But woe to the one who's alone and falls and doesn't have anyone to help. If two lie together, they keep warm. Well, he learnt that from somebody. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one might be overpowered, two together may resist. In any case, back to what he said, here's what I've found, he said. This is his life experience to the young. He's talking to boys. He's teaching. It's a boys' school. The girls didn't go to school. This is what I've found, lads, he says. It's more bitter than death is a woman who's a snare. So watch it. When her heart is a trap and her arms chains, when God so pleases, well, you, with a bit of luck, you'll escape. But if you don't, you'll get caught. Here is what I have found, he says. There it is. Comment. Kohelet is thinking of the ideal woman, the embodiment of wisdom, chokmah, feminine, Kohelet, feminine. Maybe blokes, yeah, maybe you should expect a woman to be wise. Hope for a woman to be wise, you know. Not all women live up to what they're called and graced to be, he's telling the boys. And when a woman is foolish, she can be worse than any hunter, and a man can get snared by her. Her heart can be a trap and her arms fetters. Coelet spoke earlier of the happiness that can be experienced in the communion of man and woman. We've just read that. Here she is making the obvious point that this happiness is not guaranteed. So don't fall for the first girl that attracts you, he's saying. If a man manages to escape the seduction, he should thank God, for he's especially favoured. However, since we're all sinners, he shouldn't be too surprised if he falls, he gets trapped. I suppose we should laugh about all this stuff, shouldn't we? Because it's meant to be funny. Now, what do you think of this? Look at what I've found, says Coelet to the boys in the class that he's teaching, adding one thing to another to account for the way things are, he says. Something my mind has sought repeatedly, but I've never found a solution, he says. I found one human being out of 1,000. But no woman did I find among them all. And then if I said this is the word of the Lord, which you would say if you read it in the church, you would all say, thanks be to God. You would. And then we'd go on to the responsorial psalm, and in the meantime, no one's listened to what's being said. Because there's so much folly in the world, and we've heard a lot about male folly, by the way, up till now, seeking to satisfy the longings of the human heart in power, and that was in their world a male thing, wealth, fame, success, this is the male world that he's been criticising all the way through. We've seen plenty of that. Coelet kept hoping maybe women are the answer to our dreams. Maybe they are the ones that will give us wisdom. The opportunities for women to be distracted into these false ways of wealth, power and success weren't there in the culture in which he was. So they're free from all this stuff. So perhaps, you know, he's tried everything. Maybe women will be the saviour. Surely in a woman we'll find the wisdom that eludes us. Well, he says, I don't know, I can't work it out. He said, I've tried all that too, but he said it didn't work. She was a bit of a trap and a chain. So I found one human being out of 1,000. I thought, yeah, well, that's pretty good, but no women did I find them. One might find one human being among 1,000 who lives up to the purpose for which we're created, says Coelet. But she hasn't found a woman among them. We have higher expectations of woman, but Coelet is declaring we shouldn't have these higher expectations. Don't think they're going to be the answer to all everything. She's not blaming anyone for this, Coelet isn't, but stating this is the way things are. The result is that seeking to find meaning in a man-woman partnership, maybe that's not where meaning will be for the man. She'll be his saviour. Well, pleasant as it is, it's vanity and a chasing after wind. So ultimately we're only going to find meaning. He had a lot of hope in that, but that doesn't give you meaning either. We have to transcend it. It has to be something not under the sun, is what he's really saying. We're listening to Solomon, by the way, centre stage, reflecting back over his life. So there's a bit of context to this. And remember, the tradition claimed that it was Solomon's wives. He had 700 and 300 concubines. He never had a holiday, I'd say. And there it is in 1 Kings 11:3. And the claim is that it was the women that turned his heart away from wisdom. So he's got Solomon centre stage. What he says, no way we're asking you to accept it. But do you get the point? In context, it's Solomon saying, my buildings didn't work, my success didn't work, power didn't work. Plenty of women, but that didn't work either. So it's all, there's got to be something else. And then I read to you, see, this alone I found, that God makes human beings straight, but they have devised many schemes. Who is so wise, and who knows the solution of anything, he says. Wisdom makes one face shine, so that the hardness of one's countenance is changed. Keep the king's command, but don't be hasty about oaths to God, he says. Do not stand there overwhelmed by his presence, the king's presence. Go, do not persist in behaviour that will harm you, for he'll do whatever he pleases. The king will, the ruler will. For the word of the king is powerful, and who can say to him, what are you doing? Whoever obeys the command will meet no harm. The wise heart knows that for every matter there is a time and a judgment. The troubles of humans lie heavy upon them. That no one knows what is going to happen, and that no one can tell them when it will happen. And then chapter 8, verses 8 to 9. No one has power over the life breath to detain it, or power over the day of death. There is no discharge from the battle, nor does wickedness deliver those who practice it. Apparently the custom was, if I was the landowner and we were called up by the ruler for a war, and I'm called up, I can get one of my slaves to go in my place and I can go back to the club and play the pokies. So I've got, you know, I can substitute somebody for me and therefore not have to go into a war. But he's saying you can't get a substitute when it comes to die. So ultimately, you've got to face it alone. All this I observed when I applied my mind to all that is done under the sun. While one person exercises authority over another to the other's hurt. Then I saw the wicked being carried out for burial. They came out from a holy place, temple, sanctuary, while those who have acted justly are neglected in the city, dying in the gutters. Good people. This bloke. This too is vanity, he said. Because sentence against an evil deed is not executed speedily, the human heart is set on doing evil. He got away with it. God didn't strike him down, so do a bit more. Though sinners do the evil of hundreds, they live long lives. That's what he's noticed. I know it will be well for those who fear God, who stand in fear before him, and it will not be well with the wicked who will not prolong their shadowy days because they don't stand in fear of God. Yet, even so, meaningless things take place on this earth. There are righteous people who are treated according to the conduct of the wicked, and there are wicked people who are treated according to the conduct of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity. And he concludes part one. So, back to his only theme, really. What I commend is enjoyment. For there's nothing better for people under the sun, this is the fourth time he said this, so I think we've got it, have we? Than to eat and drink and enjoy themselves. If you can't, you can't. If you can, grab it. And let everyone else grab it too. For this will accompany them in their toil through the days that God has given them under the sun. When I applied my mind to know wisdom and to see the business that is done on earth, no matter how hard people try, sleeping neither day or night, I saw all the work of God and concluded that no one can find out what's going on under the sun. However much people toil in seeking, they'll not find the answer, even though those who are wise claim to know, they cannot work it out.